We'll leave them there, and now we will like for the last part of this meeting to speak a little on what the Lord has been doing in the area where we are serving Him. We live in Southern California, in Los Angeles area. But we have a work in Mexico. The Mexico work is in what is called Baja California. It's in the on the peninsula of Mexico. If you've ever seen a map, you'll see the Gulf coming up there and the peninsula running down. We are on the northern part of that. We are located some maybe 1,500 miles north of Puerto Vallarta, where David and Los Alves live. We've had occasion to be down in Puerto Vallarta, and we've helped them with a series of meetings on the local church, had a 2-week Bible study with them, and also we were down there for their conference this past end of the year. Very happy times of fellowship that we have had with the believers there. Also, David and Lois visited in the Mexico Assembly where we work, and we enjoyed their visit as well. The believers have never had the opportunity to go down to Puerto Vallarta, but I'll say this. We are hardly there a Lord's Day that they don't pray for the work down there. They are very exercised and thankful to the Lord that works are going on elsewhere. They feel so isolated, because there's no going between as far as from different people from different assemblies. And now, when we do go there, there's a little, Ashley will remember this, there's a little hymn in the hymn book that is called Bienvenido, which is welcome, and they sing that almost every time we come. They're so happy, and the brethren are generally, you know, they give us their, what they call their abrazos, their warm embrace, and tears in their eyes, and they're just so thankful to see us there, and or any other Christians that are able to go by and give a visit with them. The work started in 1980, soon after we left El Salvador. We were 5 years in the country of El Salvador. The Lord made very strong indications to us that we were to leave. Not what we were really wanting to do ourselves, but it so happened that the Lord made those, made us to feel that that was what His will was for us. We started in that effort in 1980 in Mexico, I'm referring to. We were meeting with a group of believers that were in a home, and there were about 10 of them there at the time, anxious to go on for God, but not well taught. So we started with a series of meetings again on the local church. I have a chart that I used, and it wasn't very commodious because we sat in a patio. It was in the summertime, and the temperatures get up sometimes over 120 degrees in the shade. We also know what it is to be a little cold over there. It gets below freezing, which I know may not be a whole lot to you here in Vancouver, but they have no heating or cooling in their homes, nor in the hall, and oftentimes the water lines freeze over because of the weather being so cold in the winter. But this, our first introduction was that in the summertime, about this time of the year, I think it was in July actually, and not only was the weather very, very warm, but we were staying in a little trailer, and it was very toasty in there as well. But in the evening, we had our meetings that started around 7 or 7:30, and it was sometimes it'd go on until after midnight. In the place where we had them, they had like little logs, about like so, and they put them on buckets, and a row of those like that, and that's where you had to sit. Well, it wasn't so bad for me in that I was able to stand behind the pulpit, and what little, it really wasn't a pulpit, it was a piece of wood, that was all, but I was able to stand anyway, but the wife and the children and the rest of them had to sit on these logs for these many long hours. One of the things, too, is it's agricultural industrial area, and a lot of times the crop dusters, I'm sure you must know what those are, those little bifold planes come down and sweep right over the top of us and dropping their fumigation, their DDT, which they use over there, right over the top of us. That wheat plugged on right through it all. And the Lord was good, and the interest and exercise on the part of the believers was something to behold. It was most interesting and a happy occasion indeed. We had a series of meetings with them on different occasions like that, but we're not able to get there as often as we would care to. In fact, when we first were going like every other week. It's a 7-hour ride one way. Of course, added up 14 up and back, and we generally were able to only go for the weekends. And it was a time when we would have, we'd get home maybe 2 or 3 in the morning. Our boys, who's going to school, they would have a little sleep in the back, and we would drive, and get home at those hours, which was not very easy on us, but nevertheless, we felt the joy of the Lord being able to minister and help them, those people. As the work grew, it came to a point where we realized that, this little, house where we were meeting was not going to be sufficient. And the Lord helped and provided, and we were able to build a nice little hall. I say little because now we come to the point where we're about to the point about growing it. But it has accommodated us quite nicely up to this point. We had some series of meetings since the hall has been built, and give you an idea of how it gets in there. We have little wooden windows sliding glass, about like what you have there, I should say. And one day it was very, very warm, and I was having this meeting, and one brother over here got up and he walked over to the window, and another brother walked to the window over here, and until finally all the windows were filled with these brethren, and all that was left was my family and the sisters. And so I said to the brethren, I said, well, obviously it's very warm, we'll make this a very short meeting. And the brother over here in the shade and feeling a little bit of breeze going through that window, which he was nicely blocking for the rest of us inside, he said, oh, it's not so bad from here, brother. You can carry on for the whole hour if you'd like. Well, a lack of a little consideration possibly, but at least a zeal and a love for the Word of God, but he wanted to enjoy it in the cool of the day as best he could. But anyway, that's the way it is over there. In the wintertime, it's just the opposite. You come as bundled as you possibly can because it gets very cold. And as I say, there's no heating or cooling. The hall has served its purpose. We are now probably 25 or plus that are in the assembly there. Recently, there's been a nice number of new people that have been baptized and received into the assembly fellowship. I must tell you about one baptism that we had over there a few years back. There was in a field, and it was by a little irrigation ditch with a well nearby, and getting ready for the meeting, had our hymn books out, and the people who were going to observe the baptism was on one side of the irrigation ditch, we were on the other. Just about time to announce a hymn, I felt the sensation of something running up my leg. Well, I felt, well, whatever it is, I'll give a good heart squeeze. As I grabbed a hold of it and squeezed it for all I was worth, thinking that whatever, it should be dead now. When I let go, it wasn't dead. It was as scared as I was. And it just came right up my pant leg. And so I was able to reach in and grab it with my pocket. And I grabbed a hold of it. And I gave it a good squeeze and pulled it out of my pocket. Well, I turned over and asked one of the brethren if there was a facility available that I could use, and he couldn't understand why at this time of the night or the day or beginning of the meeting that I'd need such a thing. But anyway, found a place, and sure enough, there was a lizard about so long that it crawled up my leg. And as I say, he was happy to go, and I was very happy to see him on his way as well. But anyway, we got better facilities now. We have a little place where we have the baptisms, not too far from the hall, lizard free and snake free and all the rest, and we've seen a number of people baptized there. There's this young man, whom we have had the joy of, seen received into the assembly. Nice brethren, about in the early 20s, take good and acceptable part, and we feel our tremendous contribution to the assembly. And we would ask your prayers, and that God will preserve and protect them. They come from unsaved families for the most part. Some of their families have very strong in the Catholic religion, and they're trying to pull their boys back. They feel desperate in their way of thinking that their boys have turned to this so-called new religion, but the boys are on the other side are trying to win them for the Lord. I guess I should say that this past October we had our first wedding. This past October we had our first wedding in the hall in our building, and it really was a wonderful time of celebration. There was a nice number in. In fact, there were people standing on the outside, and from that occasion, the mother and father of the boy that was married professed to be saved. Also, his sister and his brother are showing an exercise and interest for the things of God, and we've had some conversations with them. They actually live in Mexicali, which may provide us with an opportunity to open something, a little work there in the Mexicali area. From after the wedding, we should go on and tell you about the conference that we had in the month of February. It was, again, a wonderful occasion of fellowship and joy. The Christians came out in force, as many as could. It was not the very best time to have the conference, in the sense that it was a harvest season, and some of these young men were working on their farms, and they came as often as they could, but not able to be at all the meetings. But they worked in getting other people. In fact, there's a couple of brethren that were in charge of a big mill there where they bring the cotton and whatever they were bringing in. And this one brother had a couple of employees that were very interested in the gospel, and he sent them to the conference, and he said, "I'll stand in for you." And so we felt like that was a wonderful thing. At the conference, there were at times over 150. In fact, the sisters fed 150 on a Sunday noon meal. And it was one of the things that we insisted that the Christians do, or the sisters, that they had to prepare meals that would not keep them busy during the meetings. We felt like if we're going to have a conference, then we want everybody all that are possible to be there, and the sisters included. And so they were at the meetings, and then we told them, "Listen, we have to wait an hour after the meeting's over for you to prepare. That's all right." Well, they did a wonderful job, and within 15 minutes, most of us were sitting down and having our meals. Now, the kitchen they have, it doesn't have running water. You have to go out to the spigot out there. I think it has electric. Yes, it does have one little electrical box and a little table in there. That's all it has. But like I say, they did a wonderful job. Now, that I think is about all I'm going to tell you about the work in Mexico. There's many, many things I could. And there's something that comes to mind, and I haven't shared this to any other assemblies. We had an outreach work towards the west of where our assembly is located. And we had to go, some of you have heard of the San Andres Fault. It's the big fault where the earthquake is supposed to knock California and, I don't know, greater part of the western hemisphere, western side, off into the ocean. But anyway, we had an occasion to go back on some back roads. And our truck, and different times, I had to the curves were so sharp, I had to turn and back up and turn and just to work ourselves around and go up through rocks and whatnot. But we came to this one place right where the fault line is. And they had signs saying that it was a fault line. And the bridge where you normally would used to pass was moved all about like this. You could just see right where the ground had shifted and left it where the bridge was in half. And numerous things we saw along that line that give you to understand that indeed something was going on under the ground, and who knows when all this is going to happen. You know that Los Angeles has been plagued with numerous earthquakes. riots, fires, floodings, and whatnot. We feel a little bit like we're living in Egypt, maybe more than we are in Los Angeles. But anyway, nevertheless, we're probably only getting what we deserve as far as the city is concerned. It's a city that is full of wickedness and corruption on every hand. I'll turn to my attention now to the Los Angeles area. There is an assembly we call our home base, you might say, East Los Angeles, is Spanish-speaking. And when we first started going in 1980, we were possibly 20 to 25 in the assembly fellowship. God has been good, and now there are between 60 and 70 that are in that assembly today. A nice group of young men with a nice exercise in the things of God. They have their little families they're trying to bring up in the fear of the Lord. The work in L.A., if you've ever been there, to give you an idea of what Los Angeles is like, I believe there are, I was mentioning someplace today, that there are like five different area codes and the telephones just to cover the greater metropolitan area. To also bring it down a little closer to home, if you were to take by our house and go approximately a mile and a half to the west, to the north of our house, you'll find where our two boys went to high school. There are about 3,600 students that go to that school. And then if you go about a mile and a half, a little bit more to the southwest, you come to another school, and there's a high school, and there are about 3,900 that go to that school. And about a half a mile to the south of us is another high school, and there are about 3,400 that go to that school. So in a little area not more than 2 miles away from our house or a mile and a half from our house, you have over 10,000 children going to high school. That's not counting the dropouts, which are getting larger and larger as the days go by. But that's a little bit of what's like in Los Angeles. One of the things that we've noticed here in Vancouver, you're missing something. In fact, I can scarcely understand how your bridges stand up or how your signs are able to endure the weather. You're missing something that all of us have in Los Angeles, and that's called graffiti. We thought that was part of the construction, but all over the bridges, the signs and everything, you have graffiti everywhere. So in fact, one of the boys who was basically one of the best individuals involved in that in the area where we have our outreach work in Linwood, which I'll move into at this point, he was an expert, or is an expert, at that thing. And one day I was driving with him, and he says, "Tom," he says, "you see that sign up there?" I says, "Yes." He says, "We call that heaven." I said, "I call it a sign." And he says, "Well," he says, "we call it heaven because if we can get up there and paint our symbols on there, our slogans up there," he said, "then everybody all over Los Angeles can read our slogan." He says, "Isn't it beautiful?" I says, "No, actually, I don't think there's a bit of beauty in it at all." And then he took us over and he showed me a lamppost. He says, "We call that a landmark." I says, "Well, why do you call it a landmark?" "I call it a lamppost." And he said, "Well, because if you paint on that, the lamppost was sort of a kind that you can't paint." And he says, "That way they can never take it off." And so it's a landmark for him. That's the attitude, the mentality of these people. There are different gangs in these areas where we are working. If you want to become what they call a tagger, those are the ones that run around with these little spray cans. They're on the lesser sort of gangs. They're not the ones that are toting your, what they call, shanks and guns, their knives and everything. These boys and girls, they to get into a tagger's gang, one of the requirements is, according to one particular gang that we know quite well, is you have to jump on a bus, a city bus, and from the time the bus driver starts to the time he stops and gets you off, you have to be able to paint in front of his face all the emblems or whatever they tell you to paint of their particular gang. If you don't get it done, well, then you have to go back and get another bus and do it again. Well, you can imagine what the city buses look like in Los Angeles. Our son Kenny goes down to college every day, down at about 6 o'clock in the morning. He takes the bus over there, and he sits at the bus stop some of the time, and the kids are just painting right in his face, right on the window along in the bus. So the buses are a mess as well. I thought that was important as well, to keep a bus together, but I noticed around here that you don't have it. That's so much for that type of environment. We are working in Linwood. Linwood is notorious for its gangs. In fact, I have articles at home that show that Linwood has more gangs in it than any other city in the Los Angeles County. Consequently, more gang members with it, more violence, crime, and all that goes with those sorts of things. We started in Linwood in 1981, I believe it was, losing a doctor's clinic. We didn't even hardly have a notion of what the city was like. We knew it wasn't the best of cities, but that was all right. And we used to open it every Thursday night, inviting people in. Well, if you've ever been in a doctor's office, most of us have, and they have these needles and medicine and all the rest of it, and Lane, it was all there. And here we were living in one of the drug capitals of the area, and fortunately, we thank God over and over again. He preserved us. Nothing untoward ever happened, and we were very thankful. The work started very slow. There was a sister who was wanting to come to our first night. Nellie and I had gone out into the neighborhood passing out invitations. We told her before she came or on the way, we said, generally a new work starts very slowly. And she said, well, that's right, I've never seen one before and start like this, and I'd like to be there for the very first night. Come along. Got there at 7:30. We had everything all in arranged, the lights on, the doors open, expecting the crowds to come into the dorm. And, 7:45 came and no one came, and 8 o'clock and no one came. About 8:15, we thought, well, this is the way it's going to be. And so we closed with prayer, and I told this young sister, I said, well, this is the way new work starts, as I said, very slow. So we went home, committed ourselves to the Lord, came back the next week, passed out some more invitations. 7:30, right on the dot, three ladies walked in with their children, and one of the ladies who was a spokesman said, we got an invitation last week for Thursday. We weren't able to be here. We had other engagements, but she says, we didn't want to miss it for anything. She said, would you mind please telling us what we missed out on? And I said, well, it'll be no problem doing that. Just sit down and we'll get started. Well, that's how the work in Linwood commenced. From that time, the work has grown to proportions where we outgrew the clinic. We had a time where the children were we had them in the long hallway of the doctor's clinic, and a brother was helping us, and he would walk up and down that hallway as he would teach these about 30 children and had them lined up and giving them a lesson. While I was speaking, Nellie and I were speaking to the adults in the other room. Well, it was nice to get into a place that was bigger. We were able to secure a motorcycle shop just down the road a piece. The Lord was good, and we painted it up a bit and started having meetings. The people came along and for about a year or so, and then we were hit. It happened that took a little 2-week off at the end of the year. Nellie and I went in to get ready for the commencement of the new year, and the whole place was totally devastated. A gang had broken in, and during that 2-week period, they had destroyed the whole building, setting fires on the floor, they had some old paint cans in the back, and they were just taking it and throwing the paint cans around, and all kinds of things that they did, to a point where we knew it would be impossible to use the building as it was. We thought, well, possibly the Lord is indicating to us that this means the end of the work. There's so many problems, dangers, and difficulties. We have a family. Maybe this is the end. We went home, prayed about it, and different ones of the Lord's people heard about it, and young men who are helping us, and they said, listen, if you're going to remodel, we're going to be with you. We're going to help you. So we took them at their word, and they were good to their word. And a year and a half later, after hours and hours and hours of working on weekends, and Nellie and I would be there during the week hanging drywall and doing whatever, making the purchases for the materials for that weekend so everybody would be ready to work on Friday and Saturdays. A year and a half later, we opened the doors again, not knowing what to expect, went into the neighborhood, started with a series of children's meetings. After the first week of meetings, we had over 150 that were coming to the meetings. Most of these were teenagers, and most of them involved in gangs. I can tell you about a few of them. These boys and girls that are lonely, come from dysfunctional homes. Their lives are ripped and torn. They have been, for the most part, involved in drugs, drive-by shootings, all kinds of things. We do not deal much with what we call real drug addicts, per se. Some of them are users. Most of them are peddlers. These kids are coming. It's interesting to see them. Many times you'll go into the neighborhood and they'll pack their guns with them all during the day, come nighttime for the meeting, and they'll go into their house and put their gun down, pick up their Bible, and be standing out on their front porch or front lawn waiting for us when we go by to pick them up. Boys that are my height and bigger, and coming out there. In fact, one time we were coming along and the red lights were shining. In fact, we have a prayer meeting before we go out due to the dangers and the difficulties of the neighborhood. We commend ourselves to the Lord every time. And whenever we're there praying, oftentimes you hear the sirens going by and the patrol cars zipping down the road. And we think when they're going in that direction where we pick up most of our people, you know, I wonder who's in trouble now. I wonder who got shot. We wonder what happened and what, where. Well, anyway, one day they went zipping by. And as after the prayer meeting, I went up there and heard all the police cars and the red lights and whatnot. And I'm only telling you one day. It comes to my mind which one of these one days I should tell you. But anyway, this one I come to mind is that these boys were out there, and this one boy named Jesse, he's probably 6'5" or so, big boy, and he comes and he's sitting in the back of the car, the police car. I went over there and I asked him, the police officer, I says, "What's the problem?" He said, "What did he do?" He says, "No, he didn't do anything." He said, "He was just shot at." I said, "Oh, okay." So the other kids that were waiting to come to the meeting, they showed me where what happened. Here this boy had came up to where Jesse was, and he was in a car. He backed up. He pulled out a revolver, and he got out of the car and put it at Jesse's head. And he told Jesse, he says, "I'm going to kill you." And Jesse, he's kind of a nonchalant boy, and he says, "Well, whatever." And the boy looked around, and he saw Jesse had his Bible, and all these other people, these different ones were waiting to come to the meeting. They all had their Bibles, and it sort of, I guess, threw him off. It shocked him a bit. And so instead of shooting him, he got back in his car, and when he got back in his car, he started pulling the trigger. Well, Jesse, as soon as he turned around, took off running. And he dove over a white picket fence, and he did a belly flop on the other side, just landed as flat as he could on the other side of that fence. And that man opened fire on him. And you could see about three or four bullets that went right through the fence, right over the top of his head where he had been laying. There's another boy, 16, 17 years of age. His mother told him, "You can't go to the meeting until you bring in the laundry." Well, he was out there gathering up the laundry as fast as he could to get ready to come to the meeting. And as he was walking, there was a car that was right here by the where the laundry was hanging, and he could hear the bullets going right by him and sinking into the side of the car. So that was one occasion, one experience. I can tell you many, many other experiences. We have had close calls ourselves one occasion. And Nellie was driving our truck, and I was in the back. She was in the front with the girls. I was in the back with the boys. This is when our boys were a bit younger, and they weren't coming with us at that time. Came to a cul-de-sac. In this particular cul-de-sac, there are many incidents that have taken place, but we dropped off our passengers, and just as soon as we dropped off passengers, came to the end, and Nellie was turning right up, there was a new freeway going by, and right up from that freeway, they opened fire on these kids that had come to our meetings. Well, they all ducked underneath their cars, and one boy who didn't come to the meeting had a gun, and he started firing back. Thankful to the Lord, on that particular occasion, nothing happened. The kids have found out that Tom doesn't like guns in meeting. I've had to take him away in one occasion. We had about 150 or so in the meeting, and it's quite tense, believe me, when you have this group like this and these kinds of people all in one place, and you have different people from different gangs sometimes in the same room, which we have up to this point haven't had too many problems with. But it happened that this boy came to me and he says, "Tom, I got something important to tell you." I said, "Leave me alone." I said, "I got other things that are more important." He said, "But Tom, this is quite important." And I said, "What is it?" And he said, "So-and-so has a gun." And I said, "Well, thank you, that is important." And so I went over to this person, slouched against the wall, and I grabbed the hold of him without any question. I spun him around and I frisked him, and sure enough, he had his gun and I was able to extract it. And he turned around, me glaring at me, and he says, "You can't do that." And I said, "Well, I just did." And he said, "Well, give me my gun back." And I said, "No, you're not going to have your gun back." I said, "You're going to go sit down." And I said, "If I have any more problems from you, we're getting the police in here and you're going home." And so he reluctantly went down and he sat down. And just as I had this gun in my hand, the brother who was had been leading the singing and had just prayed, he said, "Well, now it's time for our brother Baker to give his message." Well, they caught me red-handed. I had to stick the gun in my pocket and go right up and speak my message at that time. But it's probably the safest place for the gun to be. Later on, we were talking about it just a couple of weeks ago before we left, with a couple of boys that professed to be saved, and they were in the meeting and they were kind of laughing about that night. And that time, of course, they weren't safe. And they said, "Tom, you know, you're fortunate that the police didn't make a raid or a run on the hall that night, because you'd have been the only person there with an illegal weapon." And he said, "You'd have been hauled off into jail and the rest of it would have gone home." But anyway, those are some of the things that we've had to deal with. We have had about, on the average, of 2 people per year that have been killed that have come to our work through different incidents. One boy named Pacheco, I've told often about his story. He's came to our meetings. He was in gangs and involved in it quite heavily. In fact, there came a time when I told him, I said, "Pacheco," he had done a few things. I said, "Pacheco, you can't come back. This is it." And he said, he took off. And then about a week or two later, he came up to me and he says, "Tom, can I please come back?" I said, "No, Pacheco, you can't come back." Well, after about 3 weeks of this, he asked me and pleaded with me if he could come back. And I said, "Okay, come on." He came back and he seemed to have a totally different attitude about things. He listened. And one day we were picking him up, as we often did, and bought him a little something to eat, because he spent most of his time on the streets, didn't have a home or anything. And he said to us, "You know, I'm going to change my ways." He says, "My uncle offered me a job. I'm going to get out of the gangs. I'm going to start living straight," as he called it. And he says, "I'm tired of my life and don't like the way things are unfolding for me." So he got out of his gang clothes. The first check, he showed it to us. He was so pleased. And went down and went and bought some regular clothes. He looked like a regular kid on the street. And one day he came to a meeting and he had a hat on. And we insist that you keep your hats off. Maybe I should take a little deviation. I've done this a time or two. There was a sister that was coming to our meetings, and she was there for the first time. And she kind of looking around and see what was going on. And this boy was giving Nellie a hard time. He didn't want to take his hat off. And Nellie insisted that he remove his hat. And finally he did. And he said, Nellie brought him over to the sister and sat him there and said, "Okay, you watch over him. And he has a little bit of trouble keeping that hat off his head." And he says, "But you make sure that he doesn't put it back on again." Well, as soon as Nellie turned her back and went back to her place, the boy put his hat on his head. The sister walked, patted him on the leg and said, "Now, sonny, she told you to keep your hat off, so please take it off." He looked at her with a growl on his face and he says, "I'll take mine off as soon as you take yours off." And he couldn't understand why she could have one on and he couldn't have one on. But anyway, those are things that you have to deal with and try to make them understand. This boy wouldn't take his hat off. Finally, he did. And he had what he told me was that afternoon, he came and he was walking down the street and his ex-gang members jumped him. And they had a hammer and they hit him on the head. And he opened up his head about 6 inches here and about 6 inches here. And he right into his cranial. And the poor boy was just in misery. His arm was all twisted and bruised. And I says, "What are you doing here?" I said, "You should be in a hospital." He said, but Tom, I wanted to come. And I said, well, I said, I appreciate that very much, but I said, we're taking him to the hospital. And we did. We got him fixed up about 4 o'clock in the morning. He was done. And he said, well, where do you want me to take you? He said, well, I don't have a home. And I said, well, where did you spend last night? He said, well, I went to Carlos's house. We took him over to Carlos. Well, Carlos' mom wasn't too happy to get up at 4 or 4:30 in the morning to let him in. But anyway, he stayed there. And that was the kind of boy he was. One day we got a phone call telling us that Pacheco had been killed and shot in the head. Went down and went to the funeral and checked it all out. There was a boy there, named another boy. I don't mention his name because of we like to see, well, this boy has professed to be saved. But anyway, he was standing there at the casket. At this time, he hadn't professed. He said to me, Tom, where is he? I looked at him. I said, you know where he is. He said, yeah. He's in hell, isn't he? I said, well, did you ever hear of that fact he got saved? He said, no. I said, did he know how to get saved? Yeah, he knew how. He used to talk about it. I said, no. I said, no, we can't do anything for him. But I said, where will you be? He hung his head and he said, I'd be in hell too. Do you want to go there? No. The same boy. I've had him in the meeting by him and I are by ourselves and sitting there talking. And we have just a little table, chairs, and a Bible there, speaking to him about his destination for eternity. And that boy, for an whole hour, an hour and a half maybe, shook that table, shook the Bible, trembled. That's the boy that's been involved in drive-bys, drugs. What he hasn't done, I don't know. He had 2 beautiful children. His wife was 14 when she had the first baby, 16 when she had the second one. She's only about 18 today. Anyway, he just trembled at the thought of dying and going to hell. He told us just a couple weeks ago, or just before we finished. He says, Tom, I was stopping off this place where he lives, and he says, Tom, and he told everybody around him, he says, I had a lot of his friends. He says, I want everybody to listen to me. He says, I'm saved. I'm going to heaven. I called him by name, and I said, oh, that's great. I said, but how do you know you're saved? What makes you think you're saved? He said, you know, Tom, those talks you've had with me. He says, I always wanted to get saved. But he says, that one day, and he told me when we were driving, he says, you remember that day when we were driving? I said, yeah, I remember. He says, we got to such and such an intersection. Name the intersection. He says, you were telling me how I had to believe on the Lord Jesus Christ or I was going to go to hell. And that if I died in my sins, there was no hope. And he says, and that day, at that place, that intersection, I realized that the Lord Jesus died for me. He turned around to his friends. He says, you guys think that Tom can preach? He says, one of these days, he says, I'm going to preach better than Tom. I said, well, that won't be hard to do. But he says, one of these days I'm going to preach better than Tom. I said, well, I'm looking forward to that day. And I said, I'll be happy to have the first series of meetings with you. But that's his approach, his attitude. He has he'd love to see better fruit, better results. But God alone knows exactly where his standing is before him. Time's about gone here. I could tell you many other things, and let me just tell you one or two incidents more. Our boys were baptized a couple of years ago. It was their exercise. I should say baptized along with their friend Leonard Perez, who may be known to some of you here. Their exercise was to be baptized in the work in Linwood. That night of the baptism, there were like between 225, 250 people in the hall. It was just packed out, and there were about maybe a dozen or at the most 2 dozen Christians. The rest were all people out from the neighborhood. We had no idea what the response would be. Again, working with that group, we thought, boy, what if they, what could they do in a situation like that? But there was reverence and there was quietness. And all the way through the meeting, those people listened. And it was a thrill to see those boys obeying the Lord in baptism. And one by one, those big boys came up to them and said, what you did tonight doesn't mean a thing to us, but we see it means an awful lot to you, and we're just happy that we were able to be here to share it with you. And that was their attitude, a very quiet, soft, and warm attitude towards our boys and their friend that were baptized. Since then, the three boys have been added to the assembly. They have been a real help to us. They helped me preach on Tuesday nights. Tuesday night is a gospel and ministry meeting. They generally take the gospel. Glenn is our singer. He sings with the kids when they come in, does a very good job. Penny comes with me and rides in the back of our truck, and he keeps order in the back. I'll just tell you one incident that took place not too long ago. One of the boys came up behind him, and I was out talking to some of them, and he pulled out a gun, and he put it right here to Kenny's neck. And anyway, he held it there for a while, and I didn't realize even myself what was going on. And when he saw me coming, he put it back into his pocket. But that boy today is doing major time in jail for almost killing another person only about a month after he did what he did to Kenny. So these are some of the things that we've had to put up with. It's not easy, but yet there's been fruit. The Lord has been so kind, so good, and we've seen a number of different individuals saved, lives transformed. Different ones have been baptized and added to the assembly. It's exactly 9 o'clock. Can I just take a few minutes, one or two minutes, just to elaborate on a couple of more things? Out from Linwood, two new works have been established, outreaches from the outreach work in Linwood. A place called Norwalk, a lady who was coming to the meetings. She was living in a home that we call Drug City. There was all kinds of drugs going on, heroin primarily. Anyway, she herself was not doing drugs, but the people involved with her were. This particular individual, I might just say, caused us a tremendous amount of problems back a few months ago. He just got out of jail, and we were really concerned. In fact, it turned out with one occasion we had to call the police. But the Lord has been so kind and so good. It makes you want to weep, actually. This man, he could have caused us so many problems if he wanted to. In fact, he's told me many times, Tom, he says, I'd rather be in jail than be on the streets. And he says, there's nothing stopping me from killing anybody. He says, I'll be happier, safer in jail than on the streets. But anyway, the Lord has been good. He's preserved us. The work in Norwalk is going on. It commenced in this sister's home. I won't go into the process of how she received the home, but it was a work and miracle of God. She opened her home up for reaching her family. Since then, her father and her older sister has professed. Her two oldest daughters have professed. When the oldest daughter, the school teacher, heard that they were having these meetings in her home, he, a professing Christian, he made it known to his class. They started to come. He set the example. He brought his wife and children with him, and it was the way in which this Sunday school work commenced and started to grow. Glenn is the one who is doing that work while Nellie and I are in the other room having the Bible study, although now that it's grown to the proportion it is, Nellie's in there helping Glenn maintain order while I'm having the Bible study. One night, there was a group of four boys that came to the meeting. They were the rascals of the town and the rascals of the school. They had beaten up one of the school teachers and sent her home quite sick. Turned out that teacher was she was an assistant, and she came to one of our meetings, professing Christian, and she was there one night when these boys were there, and she ended up taking one of the boys that jumped her to the house. I won't go into all those details, just leave it with you. One of the boys who was coming, his mother is in Satan worshiper. She's a Satan worshiper, and she's into witchcraft and all this type of thing. Another group of boys, another family, their mother is in Buddhism. She worships Buddha. But anyway, this boy whose mother is a Satan worshiper, he's a real difficult individual to work with. He goes to counseling two times a week trying to adjust to his circumstances. He came one night to the meeting, and Glenn was talking, and after the meeting he came up to Glenn, and he wanted to know how to get saved. And for about a half hour, his friends that didn't care about him or anything sat there, and he talked to Glenn, wanting to know what it meant to be saved, and how do you know when you're saved, and all these questions that everybody asked. But anyway, he had a real exercise, and we trust that so far he hasn't professed, but we love to see him profess to be saved. I'm going to leave that there and just take a minute. out also from Linwood Work, we have a workout in Ontario. That's out into the eastern part of Los Angeles. And it's been built up from a family that was saved in the Linwood Work. They've moved out that way, and they have a real exercise for the things of God and the Word of God. I'll tell you about one boy, and then I'll finish. He's 20 years of age. He professed to be saved. He's one of the gang leaders, very, very much into all the gang activity. Since then, he's moved out to Ontario. He went to his father's house a couple of weeks ago, or before we left a couple of weeks, and a gang from the area jumped the fence and was going to steal his father's car. Well, there's a large family. They all came out, and they tried to protect and stop their car from being stolen. One of the individuals from the other gang pulled out a gun and used him as the target. Happened that when he hit him, we don't know exactly the order in which the bullets hit him. There were four bullets that hit him. One of them went through his mouth and came out the other side of his cheek on the other side. Another one came and made a furrow right up the back of his ear, and another one a furrow up here, leaving a big gash right in his head. And then the fourth one, and the only thing we can figure is that when he's hitting his head like this, he put his hand like this, and a bullet came and shattered his fingernail and his bone in his little finger, and it hit his head right here. Fortunately, it didn't penetrate the cranial. It just or the skull. It just hit right here, and that was it. And bounced away. Behind him, a little bit later, they found out they had a steel pipe, and that one of the bullets went into one side and out the other. Now, why that bullet didn't penetrate him and kill him on the spot, God alone knows. But we're very, very thankful to the Lord that He's still with us today. He really has a desire to go on for God. It's not easy. Comes from a background that is a very, very difficult background. This lifestyle of a Christian is totally something foreign to him. It's only by God's help and the working of the Spirit of God that he's going to make it through. But pray for him, and we trust that he will. He has a wife that's saved, four little children. He's 20 years. He has four little children. And the whole family, all but the father, have professed to be saved. A nice, lovely little family. We thank the Lord for them. Okay, we'll just leave it there. We do appreciate your interest and the privilege of being able to share these things with you. I'm sorry I've gone over the time a little bit. Let's pray. Our Father in heaven, we thank Thee for bringing us together today. We thank Thee for the prayers of Thy dear people, for the knowledge that Thou art a God who has an interest in us, and Thou dost always listen to our cries. We thank Thee for the life of John the Baptist. We pray that these things will be impressed upon us, and there will be a desire to serve our Lord, to be a public testimony, a witness for Him in a dark and evil world. We pray for the work of which we've been speaking. We thank Thee for opening the doors. We thank Thee for the privilege. And we ask Thee that Thou just continue to bless and save and transform lives for Thy glory and honor. Pray for other works throughout the world today. We thank Thee for every servant of Thine, blessings and help and guide and direct. We give thanks to Thee for these good things. Now, part is with Thy blessing. So we thank Thee in the worthy name of our Lord Jesus Christ.